Hello there, I'm Nastasia Tay, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, energy prices are soaring and the US wants Saudi Arabia to pump more oil. So could President Joe Biden's re-engagement with the kingdom help ease record high prices? Also this week in Japan, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida wins a new mandate, but will he carry on Shinzo Abe's economic legacy, or is a financial policy change on the cards? And in Argentina, anger grows over sky-high inflation. Can the government rein in soaring prices? And has the IMF played a role in the country's economic woes? Well, from Israel to the occupied West Bank and then finally Saudi Arabia, Joe Biden's first visit to the Middle East as president comes at a critical time for him, when his approval rating is at less than 40% ahead of the midterm elections. The war in Ukraine has set off a global energy crisis, and Biden wants the kingdom to pump more oil in order to bring down prices for Americans feeling the pinch at the pump. While relations between the traditional allies reached a historic low after the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, Biden's visit to Riyadh aims to reset these ties and convince OPEC nations to increase oil production. Other issues on the agenda also include security and relations with Israel. Well, gas prices in the U.S. hit $5 a gallon last month, and global oil prices have dropped slightly, just below $100 a barrel. That's largely because world production and refining output are struggling to keep pace with a rebound in demand, and supply is disrupted as a result of sanctions imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. The OPEC Plus alliance of oil-producing countries, which includes Russia, has agreed to speed up its output increase in July and August, adding 648,000 barrels a day. But there are production shortfalls in many member states. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are the only members who have significant volumes of spare capacity. They're estimated to have a buffer of about 3 million barrels a day together. That's around 3% of global oil output and almost equivalent to the amount that Russian oil could be kept off the market at year end. Well, to discuss all of that, I'm joined from London by Ahmed Mehdi. Now, Ahmed is a visiting fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Thanks so much for joining us, Ahmed. I know there's been plenty of speculation about potential increases in oil production in the coming months. Do you think that that's actually likely to make any kind of an impact on the oil difference, especially before the US midterms, as Biden presumably hopes?
Yes, so I think that at the moment there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of moving parts in the oil market right now. Biden's visit has put the focus on spare capacity and in particular Saudi production capacity. I think that it's important to say from the forefront that spare capacity has already been falling in any case over the past last few months. And OPEC Plus have added more to the market. So, the wedge of available spare capacity actually is going to drop anyway. And that's being priced in by the market, where we really reach about 2.3 million barrels a day of spare capacity by August, as OPEC Plus continue with their increases. So, as I said, that's already being priced in. I think the other point to remember, actually, there's a lot of uncertainty on both the demand and the supply side. Mm. On the demand side, the difference in OPEC's own forecast of oil demand growth this year is different by about 2 million barrels a day to most other consensus forecasts, taking into account demand side risks. But I think really the big issue is related to what the supply side uncertainty in a world where spare capacity begins to thin. And you have ongoing policy discussions with regards to sanctions on Russian oil, with proposals around a price cap. And really that kind of highlights the confusion that exists at the moment in terms of what the next step. So we're at a sort of turning point, and even in terms of Russian supply losses, what the estimates are also very wide.
You talked about uncertainty around supply. Just looking at the numbers, I believe Saudi Arabia's total capacity stands at about 12 million barrels per day. How long can it sustain pumping oil like that? And what does it take to produce such huge amounts?
Saudi really, you know, its OPEC plus quota for August is going to be 11 million barrels a day. You know, they've only really produced that amount briefly towards the end of 2018. And we've seen them reach 12 million, I think, just for 1 month in 2020 during the height of the price war of Russia. So really, I think that this debate about can Saudi reach 12 million, you know, and question is going to be how sustainable can they, you know, sustainable production capacity over time is the issue. However, I think really misses the point. I think what the market, you know, it's what the market believes, and the market believes Saudi messaging on their maximum sustainable capacity at 12 and a half. And the question is really, if Saudi were to test that, would they want to give away that information premium, which really holds strategic value for the kingdom? And you have to also take into account operational constraints of maintaining that production capacity over time. And then obviously the question of spare capacity, as I mentioned, with all of these supply side risks that exist in the market, you know, do you want to actually, you know, there's a trade-off that has to be taken into account for the market as well.
Ahmed, any increase in oil production would presumably require consensus from OPEC members. How likely is that? And do you see a future for Russia within OPEC Plus?
Yeah, so I think the next meeting for OPEC Plus in early August will be an important one, because really that's when they'll have unwound, you know, the cuts that they announced in mid-2020. And I think really the OPEC Plus is going to look at trying to understand, you know, they'll have to also understand, you know, what the basically what balances will look like for the rest of this year. And as I mentioned in the beginning, there is a big difference of view between OPEC's own view of oil demand growth and those of other agencies. But at the same time, I don't think that Russia will be, you know, there'll be a wedge between Russia and Saudi with an OPEC Plus. The cycle of thinking is much more long term within OPEC Plus than it, you know, and it's not going to respond to any short-term political cycle or geopolitical headwind that may occur.
Ahmed, just taking a bit of a step back here, we're looking at an energy crisis that isn't solely driven, though, by OPEC production. So what are the other challenges that have gotten us to this point?
So, yes, you're right. It's an energy crisis. It's not just, you know, it's not just an issue within the oil markets in terms of what's happening with, you know, I mean, the Russia crisis is also highlighting issues with gas. You know, you're seeing the opening of a new front in the conflict with regards to cutting back on contracted volumes of natural gas supply to Europe. European economy is closely watching whether natural gas supply returns from Nord Stream 1 following after maintenance, and that's having an impact really upon some of the central bank decision making as they decide whether or not to increase interest rates. Likewise, refining capacity has been a big issue as well. You know, we've seen about 3 to 3.5 million barrels a day of refining capacity shut since COVID started, and that's also taking place against the background of really, you know, what's going on in China as well. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, China has not been exporting as much petroleum products as last year. And so really it's not just an issue in the crude market, but also across the energy value chain. So you're seeing constraints in the refining capacity system. You're seeing record levels of prices for gasoline, jet fuel and diesel, and really that's, you know, part of the COVID return of demand, and supply hasn't been able to catch up. And so really these bottlenecks and constraints are not just limited to what's happening in the oil market, but there's a more of an interconnection now that's taking place between different fuels and markets, and you're seeing policy intervention. And I think this is what the interesting thing about this situation in oil and other markets is.
Indeed.
The role of government policy.
some interesting times ahead. Ahmed Mehdi there, a visiting fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Thanks so much for joining us here on Counting the Cost.
Thank you.
Well, Japan's upper house elections were seen as a referendum on the Prime Minister's leadership. And the landslide victory of the ruling party and its coalition partners has bolstered Fumio Kishida just 2 days after the assassination of Shinzo Abe. The result means that Kishida may now have the power to push fiscal policies, including his so-called new form of capitalism, which aims to revive the economy. The agenda includes investing in human resources, science and innovation, increasing the number of startups and promoting green and digital transformations. But the Prime Minister has also been under pressure to stick with parts of Abe's economic plan. Critics say big spending packages to cushion the impact of the pandemic and ultra-low interest rate policies have sent the yen to two-decade lows and could even accelerate inflation. Well, Abe introduced his economic policy back in 2012 in an attempt to jumpstart Japan's economy out of 2 decades of stagnation through the so-called three arrows of his namesake Abenomics policy. And they include an ultra-loose monetary policy in the form of negative short-term interest rates to make it cheaper for consumers and companies to borrow money and to spend. Pumping money into the economy by funding infrastructure projects, for example, or giving incentives to companies like tax breaks. And structural reforms, adding more women and migrants into the workforce and boosting the country's job market to push economic growth. Well, joining us now from Singapore is Marcel Tilliont. He's a senior Japan economist at Capital Economics. Thanks for joining us, Marcel. That was really quite the landslide victory there. I'm curious, do you think Kishida now has a free hand to do what he wants in terms of the economy?
He already had a pretty strong majority beforehand. He doesn't have the two-thirds majority that Abe had just a few years ago. But yes, he has. He has, at least in parliament, he has a free hand. I think the key issue is whether he can overcome vested interests and the powerful business lobby in terms of pushing through any reform attempts. And the evidence so far suggests that he is. He's not willing to offend a lot of people.
Marcel, this all obviously comes in the wake of the very snappily branded Abenomics policies. That has had mixed successes, though. What do you make of it? And do you think Kishida will depart vastly from that?
I think Abenomics, probably the biggest achievement of Abenomics has been both an improvement in corporate profit margins, which was triggered by the corporate governance reforms that were initiated by Abe, as well as a sharp increase in the labor force participation rates of women and elderly, which ensured that employment actually kept rising to fresh record highs throughout Abe's terms, despite the shrinking of the population. But I think the Achilles heel of Abenomics has been very sluggish productivity growth. And unfortunately, the tailwind from a rising labor force participation rate now seems to be fading. So elderly people are not staying in employment for much longer. Mm. And at the same time, productivity growth is still very weak. And there's no clear policy by the current government to improve that. So I think the next few years are going to be quite challenging for Japan's economy in terms of achieving strong GDP growth.
Well, much of Abenomics, especially when you start talking about the participation in the workforce, was also about addressing inequality. I understand there is this talk of some sort of new capitalism under Kishida. Do you think that addressing inequality will still be a priority for him?
Well, he unfortunately backpedaled on plans to raise the tax on capital gains and dividends. So it suggests that his initial focus has already been watered down. He has suggested in lifting the minimum wage quite aggressively, but that was something that started under Prime Minister Abe already, so it's not a shift in policy. So overall, I would think he's pretty much sticking to the status quo. There's no major shift in policy on the agenda at the moment.
Well, we are also looking at a very different Japanese economy now, given everything that's happened with the pandemic. Given the rising inflation that we're seeing, and the yen is now, at a 20-year low, do you think inflation is still going to be the focus that it is for Kishida that it was for Abe?
Unfortunately, deflation is still a threat. I mean, we are currently seeing pretty rapid price gains, but it's worth noting that the yen has depreciated at the most rapid pace since the early since the Asian financial crisis, and obviously the massive supply shortages out there. And even then, we're just going to get inflation just above the Bank of Japan's 2% target. And with energy inflation already starting to slow, it will fall back below the 2% target next year. So while deflation is probably no longer a major threat, I think that the Bank of Japan's 2% inflation target will remain out of reach for the foreseeable future.
Well, speaking of different challenges, Japan also has huge public debt. In fact, the highest public debt to GDP ratio in the industrialized world. How do you see Kishida's approach to that?
Well, I think the strong inflation that we're seeing at the moment is providing a bit of a tailwind to the public finances by boosting tax revenue. So we had the Ministry of Financing reporting just last week that tax revenue in the previous year surged by 10% to a fresh record high. So that gives Kishida a window to repair the public finances. The key question is how willing he is to not spend the windfall. I mean, we saw last year he implemented a huge supplementary budget last year, equivalent to about 60% of GDP. He already announced another admittedly small supplementary budget at the very start of the current fiscal year. So it remains to be seen whether he's willing to not spend the windfall and slash spending now that the economy is opening up again after the pandemic.
Interesting times indeed. Marcel Tillions, the senior Japan economist at Capital Economics, thanks again for sharing your thoughts with us here on Al Jazeera.
Thank you.
Well, while rising inflation didn't seem to discourage Japanese voters from supporting the ruling party, the rising cost of living is challenging Argentina's government. Thousands of Argentinians marched in the capital last week, urging the government to resign while rejecting IMF loans, which come with tough conditions. May inflation exceeded 60%, and the value of the peso has fallen after the country swore in a new economy minister. Teresa Bo reports now from Buenos Aires.
It's one of the most challenging jobs in the country, managing Argentina's economy in times of trouble. Silvina Batakis was sworn in as economy minister by President Alberto Fernández, promising to jumpstart Argentina's economy.
We are convinced Argentina's direction has to do with our fiscal management, following the president's economic program, and of course boosting Argentina's exports and revaluating our currency, which is achieved with more reserves.
But doing so won't be easy. Batakis is replacing Martin Guzman. He was in charge of the tough negotiations of over $40 billion with the International Monetary Fund. Even though the negotiations proved successful, Guzman was constantly attacked by the powerful former president and now vice president, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, who did not agree with the handling of the economy.
Argentina is struggling with very high inflation, around 5% a month, high poverty and exchange rate controls that have a huge impact in the economy. A change in the Ministry of Economy generates lots of uncertainty in a country like Argentina, and that uncertainty increases the price of the US dollar on the streets. And that, in most cases, means more inflation.
Argentines are used to living in crisis. They have survived one every other decade. People on the streets are watching the latest developments very carefully.
Obviously, there is a lot of uncertainty. We don't know which direction we are going, right or left, whichever. But what Argentines need is a direction, and sadly, we don't have one.
Tensions have been running high between President Alberto Fernández and Cristina Kirchner for months. Batakis' appointment is seen as a win for the far-left-leaning faction in government who are close to the vice president and critical of the agreement with the IMF.
Populism needs money to calm the people down, and there is no money. They have no money to give away, and whatever they will give, they will have to print, and that will increase inflation even more. We have a huge problem. I don't see a way to make it work.
Batakis has a difficult task ahead. She has to fight inflation, generate jobs, and increase the country's reserves without displeasing Argentina's vice president, who for many has now more power than the president himself. Teresa Bo, Al Jazeera, Buenos Aires.
Well, joining us now on Skype from Andalusia in Spain is Ximena Blanco. She is the Research Director and Head of America's Risk Insights at Verisk Maplecroft. Thanks so much for your time today, Ximena. We're looking at, obviously, skyrocketing inflation in Argentina, something expected to hit, what, 80% this year? Obviously, we're seeing inflation become a problem in many different parts of the world, but why specifically are we seeing such a huge rise in Argentina?
Well, I mean, one of the big problems of Argentina is that it's been struggling with inflation now for several years, right? And this is accelerating quite quickly on the back of two things. The number one is domestic policy, right? A very expansionary monetary policy. If we just look at the last month, between mid-June and early July, the central bank added the equivalent to 1.4% of GDP in money being printed, right? So this is a huge problem for the country. And of course, we have now the second added issue, which is Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the impact it's had on fuel and also on fertilizers, which obviously Argentina being a huge agricultural powerhouse is also impacted by.
Well, given the central bank's decisions, how do you even begin to tackle inflation when we're in the situation that we're in now?
One of Argentina's main economic problems is a political one, actually. There isn't a political will to tackle the problems. The central bank is not independent, and the executive is embroiled in a power struggle within the ruling coalition. So, you know, part of the problem, the policy problem, is that there are no policies, and that the policies that have been announced and repeated this week are not convincing markets that Argentina is capable to get its economy back in order. So really the question is, you know, how much worse can the country get before there is the need for some shock measures? Because unfortunately, you know, Argentina is heading for another Argentina-style crisis.
Well, you talk about this political power struggle. Is there then the space for the new economy minister to do what needs to be done at all? Or is there not the autonomy for her to operate in that way?
Well, I don't think it's even an issue of autonomy, because I don't think the previous economy minister had the autonomy either. And one of the key issues with the new appointment is that it wasn't an appointment made out of choice for the, you know, the best economy minister that the country could get, but it was rather the choice based on who could President Fernandez and his VP Kirchner agree on. So it was kind of a, you know, the decision was made on reaching a truce rather than, you know, looking for the economy minister who could lead the country out of a crisis. And in fact, you know, for anyone who followed the situation in the country, there were several other potential candidates that came before Minister Batakis. So even just by, when taking office, she's taking office with an impression that she doesn't have the authority or the independence to implement even the agreement that Argentina has reached with the IMF.
Well, I want to turn to the IMF because there's obviously a huge disagreement on how that relationship should be approached, even within the ruling coalition. So what do you make of that going forward? What should we be looking for?
Well, I mean, this will be the clear bone of contention between President Fernandez and VP Kirchner. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think that Argentina's problem is solely economic, but it's a political one. And the IMF will be a very useful scapegoat in any crisis that comes next. And, you know, the agreement with the IMF itself, the country is already, you know, failing to deliver on it, you know, bringing down the fiscal deficit to 2.5% of GDP this year. Now, you know, it's the stuff of pipe dreams. And the reality is that, you know, the IMF has limited room for maneuver. Because Argentina's problem is the IMF's problem, and the IMF doesn't want to get burnt once again in the region, let alone with Argentina. But if the government in Buenos Aires is unable to resolve its internal problems, then, of course, the IMF is a great candidate to become the culprit of Argentina's next problems.
Ximena Blanco there from Verisk Maplecroft. Thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us on Al Jazeera.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this week. Do get in touch with us by tweeting me, at Nastasia Tay, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's also more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. Well, that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nastasia Tay. From the whole team here in Doha, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.